You're listening to Classic Dialogues, Land Power in the Indo-Pacific, a China Land Power Study Center production. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm in the studio with Josh Arostegui, chair of the China Land Power Study Center. What do you want to talk about, Josh, and why is it important?
I've been asked a lot of questions about protracted warfare in the Indo-Pacific specifically. For those listeners who have heard previous podcasts from us, it's a major portion of our research agenda this year. One of the topics I've been asked about was not necessarily, you know, numbers of airplanes and ability to fight, but how China is able to potentially sustain some of its forces during a protracted conflict. I presented some information recently, and I thought this would be worth putting on a podcast. My whole point in doing this is to tell the listeners a few things they may not really know about China's capacity for this, especially from the military-civilian fusion perspective. And I don't necessarily just mean state-owned enterprises developing new technologies. I mean militia, I mean defense industries, working with the military representative offices. You'll hear all about it shortly.
Does China talk about protracted war at all the way America does?
The answer is not really. As a warning to listeners first, I really want to preempt something here. If my comments about this whole topic really make you want to research more on protracted war, I highly recommend that you not Google the term protracted war, Churjiojan, in Chinese, unless you really are prepared to read endless versions of like Mao Zedong's classic text on protracted war. And I also want to really preemptively tell everybody that I'm not going to be getting too tactical in this one. My goal here is to tell listeners something they probably just have only heard a little bit about. But the first thing I want to comment on is how the PRC addresses execution of a protracted conflict in its most authoritative texts, these texts on military strategy and operations. I'll answer my own comment right now. As I said earlier, it doesn't talk about protraction much. Texts like the PLA National Defense University's Science of Military Strategy and various other national defense white papers provide recommendations or guidance on how to shape the force, but they're not warfighting documents. Many of the PRC's most well-known books on operational art, like The Science of Campaigns, make several references to protraction. However, all these references are really just warnings to avoid getting into a protracted conflict. So similar to how we view warfare, the PRC plans and prepares to resolve conflicts as quickly as possible. Well, at least according to all these numerous defense publications and its history, the short conflicts that shaped the PLA in the decades following the Korean War. So 1962 Sino-Indian border conflict, 1979 Sino-Vietnamese border conflict, etc. Those roughly month-long events resulted in the PRC claiming completion of its objectives and the immediate pullback of its forces. Yes, the Sino-Indian border is still contested to this day, and the conflict with Vietnam continued well into the 1980s. But neither would really fall into the classification of what we view as a protracted war. The Korean War, on the other hand, might be a better case study of why the PRC, even one that continues to modernize its massive force to take on this strong enemy, could still find itself in an unplanned protracted conflict. Just like in Korea, if the PRC makes good initial gains in any kind of war and maintains these really strong anti-US feelings that it currently has, it could refuse a ceasefire, and well, you guys know the rest for those who know their history. But even when The Science of Campaigns, another book I mentioned earlier, was updated in 2006, in an era when the PLA was really only beginning to emphasize modernization of its force, the need for speed to avoid protraction was noted in just about every chapter. The only exception included the joint blockade campaign based on an expectation of a prolonged effort to force the adversary to submit, and unsurprisingly, a positional defense campaign when necessary. So I want to touch on the defensive campaign here specifically. In People's War, or also called Protracted People's War, the strategic defensive works to attrit the enemy before the achievement of a strategic stalemate that ultimately leads to the strategic offensive. That's what they call it. The question should be asked, does the PRC still adhere to a People's War doctrine in their military planning? The answer is kind of. Those texts I mentioned above, even those that are relatively modern, like the 2020 Science of Military Strategy, still point out the superiority of People's War and how future integrated joint operations must use that concept for victory. Does this mean they expect to let their opponent land on the Chinese mainland while they conduct a strategic defensive? Not at all. What it does mean, though, is that the PRC has not changed all that much since the Korean War when it comes to mobilizing its population to support a massive conflict.
What are some of the key things that maybe our listeners might not know about China's ability to carry out a protracted conflict?
I'm going to touch on 3 points here. First, let me make a brief comment on China's defense industry. There are far smarter people that have written on China's defense industrial complex. But I want to delve a little deeper so you can understand how that complex remains militarized even during times of peace. There are numerous enterprises, often called SOEs, that effectively hold monopolies on specific weapons platforms. While competition is growing in some areas between these SOEs, such as in missile development, They each remain focused on the research and development and production of their primary systems. What most people don't realize is how extensive the production capacity of those SOEs can be. I'm sure many of you know there are like 13, something like that, large shipyards in China that can produce large numbers of commercial and naval vessels, one of which is capable of building more than all of ours combined. What you may not be tracking are the SOEs like the ordnance industry, something I've spent a career doing. That industry, made up of two large companies that each have dozens of sub-elements, each with their own production capabilities, is incredibly expansive and can produce the same equipment in multiple locations. With something like 2.8 million factories and production plants around China, it's really difficult to know where all the defense-related materials are being produced or coming from. And this topic is really just too broad to go into detail here, but their direct lines to the CCP and the PLA would make them of immediate use in support of China's future conflicts, especially those that are protracted. Those direct lines to the PLA really come from the military representative office construct that still exists in China. This is something I think is highly underrated, and most people don't recognize or realize the level of importance it holds within the PLA. In China's pre-structure era, each service had its own MRO in factories, transportation hubs, and other industries critical to war efforts. Nowadays, the Central Military Commission Equipment Development Department has a military representative office bureau that oversees the program. Following the major PLA restructure back in 2016 and 2017, many of those MROs now fund the PLA Joint Logistics Support Force, but they continue to serve the same function. Charged with quality control and contract execution, MROs are found in every weapons production plant and any other factory that really develops or produces equipment for the PLA. Traditionally, these positions were easily corruptible and severely overworked. However, Xi's PLA appears to have refined these positions to reduce redundancy while also increasing the requirement and expertise and education to fill them. So basically, Xi just doubled down on these. A lot of us thought during the reorg that these positions may either go away or be transitioned to something else, but instead, Xi Jinping made these things far more difficult in the sense of higher education requirements and training. So their existence gives China a leg up in the race to produce military goods during a protracted conflict. I also want to point out that the MROs play a pivotal role in coordinating PLA transportation. Every railroad hub, airport, civilian transit authority, etc., they all have an MRO. When trains need to transport PLA equipment long distances, the MRO coordinates the efforts between the unit logistics personnel and civilian authorities. The same thing happens when civilian heavy equipment transportation to get required military vehicles to the train station is needed. Unsurprisingly, when civilian ferries have to transport military equipment, guess who coordinates all of that? Yep, it's the MROs. So these officers are really a linchpin in keeping the military-civilian fusion process going during peacetime. And if you believe Chinese media, they train to ramp up those functions during a time of war. So their roles will be critical in sustaining PLA forces involved in a protracted conflict. And one final aspect I really want to talk about when it comes to China's preparedness is something very few experts typically feel comfortable talking about, simply because there's not a lot of information out there on it. It's the militia. Despite an abundance of PLA daily articles and CCTV videos publicizing militia training events or disaster relief operations, little is really known about the size and scope of China's third armed force, the other two being the PLA and the People's Armed Police. Experts provide a wide range of total numbers, anywhere from something like 4 million to 8 million. Most of the assessments I've seen lead towards the larger side of that number. Of civilians that really train annually to handle wartime functions in uniform. Militia forces fall under the CMC, National Defense Mobilization Department, and are controlled through a provincial military district and sub-district organization. So many of these guys serve in traditional military roles like infantry, air defense, transportation, and even in guard units. But they also make use of civilian expertise that can be leveraged during a time of war. Factories can have their own militia platoons or companies, while towns can have entire militia battalions. These forces really can be called to action during a time of war to not only perform the same types of jobs they were doing as civilians, but also be implemented into homeland defense roles that lessen the burden on PLA and People's Armed Police Forces. There are militias made up of port workers, which, in my opinion, would clearly be an important function during a time of war. There are militias that can be called to assist with farming. There are also militias that can be used to supplement cyberspace operations within China. Having a multi-million person ready to activate armed force that can be ordered to perform key functions within China's industrial production and transportation bases really gives Beijing a leg up here when it comes to sustaining protracted conflict. And yes, the infamous maritime militia also falls under that National Defense Mobilization Department and can clearly support a host of maritime capabilities in the event of a protracted conflict. Experts like Lonnie Henley have written extensively on the topic of how maritime militia could be used for everything from landing first echelon PLA forces in a cross-strait campaign to enabling continuous sustainment for forces already in Taiwan. The civilian ferries that fall under the maritime militia have also been training for operations on the Korean Peninsula for years and could be capable of transporting, sustaining anything for those PLA forces there, in addition to those coming from the Sino-Korean border. So despite the advantages that having a potentially huge civilian workforce eligible for mobilization, while also having a permanent military presence in the massive defense industrial complex, it really remains to be seen how effective such a concept would be in a protracted war. My point in discussing each of these ideas really is to inform the listeners that China's been thinking about this type of war for decades. I want people to take a step back when looking at the building of modern Chinese warships and aircraft and hypersonic weapons to understand that what China is creating is a standoff capability as well as a force designed to go global, as their military strategy documents frequently denote. However, most of Beijing's highest priority national defense issues are really based on hotspots around its periphery. Think of like the Sino-Indian border, even the Korean Peninsula, or Taiwan for that matter. Any of those hotspots really could lead to a protracted conflict for China, even on multiple fronts. Industrially speaking, I'd say they're probably better prepared for that eventuality than most realize.
The 3 points you mentioned, defense industries, military representative offices, and militia. Do these actually make the PLA more capable of fighting a protracted war?
Honestly, even if the Chinese defense industry is capable of pumping out munitions and the MULSA fusion is working like it should to help transport forces and supplies, would a conscript-heavy force like the PLA be successful in using its force to maintain a prolonged action outside of its borders? As much as I hate to say it, it's going to be, it depends. Much of the PLA's new sustainment capacity comes from the reorganization of older units to streamline logistics functions. In addition, they create a more integrated support structure with the stand-up of that joint logistics support force. Those systems remain heavily reliant on that MILSIV infrastructure that exists within China. So when Chinese forces are occupying key and decisive terrain outside of its borders, it will have to maintain maritime and air superiority to make use of those civilian militia elements. If the majority of its actions during a protracted war are centered on long-range fires that can take place for the mainland, well, then that MILSIV integration should theoretically work as expected.
Josh, thank you for making time to record this podcast today.
Thanks, Stephanie.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, Conversations on Strategy, and SSI Live.